Okay. Flat.
Yeah, So I might just like, I either want to just take a next one or wait till spring of the
year. They were
So I want to welcome you to this Center for Biological Explosion. My name is Jonathan Moreno, and I teach in the Center and Department and in History and Sociology of Science. And I got to choose this speaker tonight as part of the course on the body politic that I'm teaching. No question but that Will was far and away the first choice that I had for my spot in the colloquium series this year. Will is, from the point of view of the subject matter of the body politic, the perfect choice. And those of you who are not in the course, that's tough, but you will also benefit greatly from hearing Will. I think he is the most interesting observer of the culture wars of bioethics and politics in the last dozen years or so that we have. Many of you are familiar with his column on called Human Nature, the Human Nature series in Slate. He publishes under other monikers in Slate and elsewhere. And many of you also are familiar with his book, Bearing Right, How the Left Lost the Abortion War. So Will is an acute observer of all of the issues that are of concern to people in our master's program. And I also want to welcome faculty and delegates, ambassadors of other institutions here. Really pleased to see you. A great compliment to Will also that folks are showing up from other places. So, Will, take it away. And Will will talk for about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll open up. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming. So, first, I was going to try to do some sort of an argument for you guys, and I thought, you know, that isn't what I do for my job. What I do for my job is sort of the opposite of what an academic does. I have to, like, last night I was going to write this week about what the scandal at Syracuse, and then a woman comes out and accuses Herman Cain of adultery, consensual adultery, and I'm like, suddenly I'm writing about Herman Cain. So my life is, you think you're doing something, 30 minutes later, something happens, and you're doing a completely different thing. So I literally am moving on from one day to the next, and sometimes from a shorter period than that. So what you're going to get from me is a lot of breadth and not enough depth. But hopefully that'll be sort of mix in well with some of what you normally get, which is lots and lots of depth, but sometimes not enough sort of spreading out. So in my world, stuff is just constantly churning through the news cycle, and my job is to sort of find things that are interesting that illustrate patterns and tease out what those patterns are and bring them to my readers. And it's not really so much, I think when I started doing this, I thought it was going to be a matter of applying to changing circumstances and changing stories a set of values or ideas. And that's not at all what it is. What it is things change, news happens, technology and science fundamentally transform certain questions, and so your values change. So it's not that you're coming in with the a priori notions about what's right and wrong, and you're applying them. It's that, wow, I thought I understood this issue, but something comes along, and now it's a different question. Okay, and I used to cover, Jonathan will tell you, I used to cover politics, and I still do cover politics. And politics is often the same story over and over again. In science and technology, it's not the same story, because when things change, they really change. Okay, they change fundamentally. And if we don't go back because we have a better understanding or a better technology. And they're just never the same way again. So what I did is I threw together just a bunch of stuff that's been going on from, I picked from the last 2 months. And I just grabbed stuff from Reuters, from AP, New York Times, and a couple other places. And I'm just going to go through them. And I just highlighted things that are interesting. And my hope is that I'm going to spend about half an hour doing this. And then just throw it open. So take notes of anything that's interesting to you that you want to flag. And we'll just come back. Because most of what I learn, at least, and I can't speak for everyone here, but most of what I learn is from conversation. It's not even from reading a single author. It's from the interaction of one or more people. And certainly not from listening to myself. So I'm going to try to get that part over with early. Okay. And I've done one PowerPoint in my life before, but I'm going to try to sort of... The guy who covers technology knows squat about this, right? I may ask for somebody's roadside assistance.
Oh, okay. That reminded me.
Yeah. The recording.
I think it's running.
Is it running?
I think it's running.
When he said the guy who knows squat about technology writes about it, I thought it was on.
Right, and did the philosopher ask any of you guys for your consent before we started the recording? I don't think so. Okay. Okay, so now this is just something, you guys are in Philadelphia, so you know all about the Gosnell case. And here we have, you know, this case is ongoing and people are being, you know, charged with things. And I just started out with this because these are two women who are involved in the case who are pleading to the same murder charge, but one of them for killing a 41-year-old patient and one of them for killing a baby. If they deliver the baby, then they kill it, okay? And if they leave the baby inside, it's an abortion. It might be a late abortion. We don't know in a lot of these cases how late these abortions were. But the point is, after the point of birth, the person, they're being charged with the same crime. So there's an equivalence being drawn between the freshly born child, and an adult. And this is where the pro-life movement has made its money. It's not its money. This is their bread and butter. It's arguing about abortions very late in pregnancy when the line between a fetus and a baby gets very thin, right? Okay. Now what just happened in Mississippi, for those of you who followed, is there was this proposal which has actually been tried in Colorado before, and now they're trying to get it in seven other states to declare embryos people under the law. Okay, and they bring this before the voters. And if ever there was a state that was gonna pass it, it's Mississippi. And they lost. They lost 58-42. Okay, and they were surprised by this. They shouldn't have been. And the national pro-life groups didn't support them. The Catholic Church didn't support them. Why? There's some complicated legal arguments, but the number one reason why this is a bad idea politically, as long as we're talking about biopolitics, is you have first of all moved the abortion debate back from the end of pregnancy to the beginning. Okay, so now you're talking about, instead of people saying, well, this is sort of a fetus, but it's sort of a baby, so it's really important. Here it's like, well, this is an embryo, but it's almost, this hasn't even implanted yet, this is freshly conceived, it's that close to an egg. In fact, our Kaplan will tell you there's an argument for calling this a fertilized egg. So that, now we're blurring it at the other end of the spectrum, where people are very pro-choice. You've got to be kidding me, you're going to take away, birth control and stuff like that. So if I've highlighted the parts that I think are kind of relevant here. So they brought it back to the beginning of pregnancy. In fact, pre-pregnancy, because their pregnancy doesn't technically begin until implantation, although we'll get to that. These guys, the personhood people, these pro-lifers, they weren't blindsided by the fact that they brought in all these other technologies. Cloning. They have cloning. That's in the language of it, right? They really wanted to be morally consistent. We're going to declare embryos are people from the moment of conception, and we're going to apply that in every context. Okay? So you see what happened to them. They got beat. And well, how did they get beat? They got beat because people were anti-abortion in Mississippi. Oh, there's plenty of anti-abortion sentiment. But they got into all this other stuff. Morning after pills, okay? Contraception, IUDs, IVF, okay? IVF totally messed them up. One of the best books written about abortion, Kristen Luker, Abortion and the Politics of Motherhood. The argument is, the abortion debate is about having babies, it's about being a mother, you know, believing in procreation and child-rearing. Well. And people are very strong. Well, now what you've done is you're messing with a technology that is about procreation. So now you've taken these people who are, you know, pro-life, pro-baby, and all that, and you've messed with their technology. The executive director of the campaign for this amendment has two IVF kids. Right? Two IVF kids. He says, well, I'm not against that. I'm just against, you know, the part where you destroy as long as you can do this without... Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, so you've brought... This technology has completely changed the political question. Here, this stuff about 20 weeks, restricting abortions at 20 weeks, that is what the National Right to Life Committee is pushing, that kind of stuff. And that's where the polls are on their side. And ultrasounds. And we'll get to the ultrasounds in a minute. That's another thing that comes up here. Okay, the IUD. The guy who ran the campaign for Amendment 26 gets on TV, gets on the radio and says, that's not true that we mess with hormonal birth control. Birth control pills, unaffected, they don't, you know. He says IVF unaffected. Well, actually, first of all, let's go look up. Here's what the manufacturer of the Mirena IUD says. No single explanation, but it prevents pregnancy in several ways. Preventing fertilization, preventing ovulation, making the lining of your uterus thin. Well, that's code. Making the lining of your uterus thin means, just in case we failed to prevent the ovulation and the fertilization, your uterus will be inhospitable when the embryo tries to implant. So this is after conception, but pre-pregnancy.
Excuse me.
So it does mess with the IUD if you say life begins at conception. Okay. Here's what the government, the NIH, National Library of Medicine, says about these various hormonal contraceptives. Morning after pills, levonorgestrel, iloprostol. Again, you can see, yeah, it does all three, basically. You met all hormonal birth control, prevent the release of the egg, prevent the fertilization, but just in case, changing the lining of the uterus. True here. And the guy who ran the campaign said, oh, but it's regular birth control, it's not a morning after pill, doesn't matter. Same theoretical effect. Okay, I don't want anybody here to leave with a misconception about this, so to speak. I've had long arguments about this. There is an argument that it almost never prevents implantation. Basically, the other processes are stopped, so you don't get to the implantation stage. But you cannot guarantee that. And if we just don't know. What we know is that a pregnancy doesn't result. We don't know, and we know that that's the backstop. Okay, here's what the guy said. The guy who ran the campaign said. This initiative will not affect IVF. You just can't destroy an embryo as part of IVF, right? You can make the embryos in the dish. You can implant them. Okay, here's what ASRM says. Your options are: if you take the hormones, you have all these eggs. You can either flush them, you can freeze them, or you can transfer them to the womb. Okay, if you transfer them to the womb, here's what you're up against. All right, you're endangering health, you're endangering life, you're endangering, so there's the life problem with that. Okay, all right, well that's okay, we can freeze them. And in fact, the guy said, we can freeze them, no problem. The guy does not understand what he is saying. You're talking about freezing people, okay? What happens when you freeze people? Not good things, okay? And here's what ASRM says, many embryos do not survive the cryo, you know, and this is just stands to reason. And they can try to improve it, but the odds are that you're going to damage it, or that it doesn't result in a conception, means you've killed the person. So this technology has messed up their whole issue. Okay, this is what I was saying about pregnancy. Okay, there is the pro-choice definition of pregnancy, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Pregnancy doesn't begin until implantation, right? So the week in between fertilization and implantation, it's not a pregnancy yet. But they went out and they talked to doctors, they surveyed the doctors, and the doctors said, actually, most of them said, yeah, that's a pregnancy. So what we have here is they're trying to use science to sort of, you know, settle something that is not fundamentally scientific. Calling it a pregnancy has become a moral term. Once you say there's a pregnancy, now you're terminating a pregnancy if you stop it, right? So the line is being debated. I thought most of this stuff about personhood was totally theoretical. Right, that these people coming up with this thing in Mississippi won't actually affect anybody. And it's cute. All my friends write something about, you know, Social Security benefits. You know, you get them 9 months earlier than you would have because you're actually, the age stuff is not a big deal. But this is a big deal. Okay, this is really happening. Right. So what you have is here is the Supreme Court has accepted this case, and the appeals court has already ruled on this. Right. And what you have down here is that this is not a one-time case. So the court's taking this because this is going to be a bigger deal. You have more and more of these posthumously conceived children. You were, you know, if you are in the dish and you are a person, then you already exist and you are an heir, right? Or you are you're eligible for the benefits of being a dependent, which is what this is about. So there is already, it's already hitting the legal fan. Here's the actual case. This was not an embryo in a dish. That's what fascinates me. The husband has deposited the sperm. Okay, first he gets diagnosed, right? He's diagnosed with the cancer. Oh my God, let's have a baby. They don't make the embryo, they deposit the sperm, okay? Let's see, she then goes, she undergoes IVF. Do I have this wrong?
He dies.
He dies, but I believe that she does the IVF. He's dead. It's too late. So she's done. He's dead before there is a conception, right? But the court has taken this case, and the appeals court, I believe, has ruled for her. Yeah. And it has to do with how the state law, whether the applicable state law would allow a posthumously conceived child to inherit property. And clearly, they're going to have to mess with the legal standard here. But you can see all the thorny stuff that's getting raised by treating the. And this is without the Mississippi thing passing. This is right. This is federal. But you can see what's created by messing with the personhood stuff. Okay. Now we get this is into stem cell research. Okay, so we have embryos, and I think there was a joke. There used to be a joke going around about, oh, if only embryos, you know, there's one about if only men could have children, abortion would be a sacrament. And there's, you know, if they could make, you know, something out of embryos, the whole politics of abortion would change. In fact, now they can make things out of embryos, the politics has changed. So, and I've joked with Jonathan about this. This is heaven from a political point of view for the left, because all of a sudden the embryo people in the stem cell fight were up against the disease lobbies, right? Wait a minute, there's a chance that this research that you're getting in the way of might save my life. Never mind, you know. And the disease lobbies are incredibly powerful, and politically, just for a politician to get up there and say, I believe in stem cell research, it can save lives. That's a whole topic we should talk about, but it's very complicated, the adult, the embryonic stem cells. So stem cells is a huge political winner for the left, and it's sort of dissipated in recent years, but I assume that something like that will come back. You can see that here's the European court ruling on this, and I haven't read I need to read the whole court ruling on this, but they cite human dignity, and I would love for someone, maybe we can have a conversation about dignity and someone can explain to me what the hell it means. Francis, the Catholics have been talking about dignity for a long time, but as far as I can tell, dignity is like Plato, and you can pretty much make and I don't mean Plato the philosopher. you can pretty much make anything out of it. So I don't know what the hell the court is talking about when it says respect for human dignity. Basically, this court is trying to integrate like German ethics with, you know, Spanish and French. It's a mess to try to make a single court ruling out of a single ethic in Europe, but that's what they're trying to do. What I really want you to notice is that who's fighting this case? Greenpeace. And I know you guys who are in Jonathan's class, you've seen this stuff about the Greens. And how left and right get confused on these issues. The guy from Greenpeace, who brought this case against the stem cell research, says he wants to. The court said that ethics take priority over commercial interests. My joke about the liberals and bioethics sometimes is liberal. They're not sure. I get a group of liberals together in a room. They're not sure whether to be against capitalism or against religion. So they're really torn on this issue. So here's the Greenpeace guy saying, well, capitalism's on the other side. That's bad, so let's be, you know, I'm oversimplifying, I'm not entirely being fair. But basically that's what's going on. And meanwhile, you know, there's other liberals who are like, what are you doing? You know, you're on the side of, you know, the religious right. But it gets messed up when it becomes a commercial thing. Okay, so we have the pro-life people and their political difficulties at the end. If you're pro-choice, you have problems. First of all, you have problems with the situation like in Philadelphia, where you're pro-choice, but now you have a case where there are these abortions happening in the third trimester for reasons that are, you know, they're not terribly well warranted, if you ask me. And like, I want to be pro-choice, but do I really want to go this far? Here you have people have the right to choose. And one of the things that they want to choose in some countries is, I want a boy, not a girl. Okay. And you can see the result in Albania. You have a 112 to 100 ratio of boys to girls. In China, in parts of China, it got to be like 120 to 100. That's a lot of, that's millions and millions of female fetuses being aborted because they're female. And yeah, you can attack the underlying reasons, but how comfortable are we with that? So what you have is a technology that's been introduced that has made this much easier to do. Okay, so you can screen the fetus for sex, and now you can know it's going to be a girl. So instead of taking the girl baby out and exposing them and killing. This used to be neonaticide back in the good old days before we had any of this. And now it's abortion. So that's been, from my point of view, a moral improvement created by the technology of screening. And people get concerned, people get upset about, you know, my God, you're screening fetuses for, but, you know, it used to be babies. So now they're doing it, they're screening the fetuses. And you can see how economics enters into this. When you can get the cost down, cost is a huge deal. And cost changes culture. People who wouldn't have done something before, now they can afford it, and they say, gosh, you know, I can, this is something we can do, let's find out whether this is pink or blue. And, you can do this with IVF, but it's much more expensive to do pre-implantation diagnosis. And actually, what's going on with this technology is we're being able to identify things about, you know, pre-born children or fetuses, or whatever you want to call them, earlier in the process. And yeah, that makes more people do it, but it also means that what you're doing it to, if you're terminating, is that much less. So when you get down to PGD, you're saying, I don't want this embryo in the dish. Well, if you're a person-to-person, you're like freaked out by that, right? You have all these people more and more people are going to do this as the technology becomes cheaper and easier to do, and they're not even doesn't even look like a baby. Well, yeah, that's because it's less like a baby. So, you know, there's another point of view about this, which is that it would be great to have this technology drive the process back through pregnancy to before pregnancy, and to make it affordable for people, so that we could, if there's going to be eugenics, it's going to be at an earlier process, at an earlier point. Here's another case, Down syndrome test. This isn't the most interesting clip, it's just the one that was from the last couple of months. But it's a test for Down syndrome, and this is actually eliminating, this is making it less likely that you're going to have a miscarriage. So if you are going to abort this pregnancy for Down syndrome, at least it's going to be deliberate and there's going to be fewer terminations, accidental terminations of completely healthy fetuses. Okay, and oh, yeah, here's the thing. It can be used as early as the 10th week. So once again, the test kit can happen earlier, and that makes it easier morally and practically. Okay, enough about the fetuses and the embryos. Homosexuality. I love this story. I don't know how many of you followed this. Guy gets fired he resigned from his job working for the Catholic bishops. He wrote a column in The Pilot, this Catholic newspaper in Boston, implying that the devil was responsible for homosexuality. Big no-no, right? They retract the column, and when they retract it, they deleted it from the web, right? So no one will ever see this again. We're going to purge this, pretend this never happened. But unfortunately, on the internet, there is no way to delete things permanently, so this is resurrected. This is what the guy wrote. I'm just going to read it to you, because it's really interesting. He's trying to grapple with the science of homosexuality and the Catholic doctrine about it. No one has found a gay gene. Identical twins are always, of course, the same sex, providing further proof of male and female genes. If there was a gay gene, then when one twin exhibits same-sex attraction, his or her identical sibling should too. But that's not the case. The incidence of finding identical twins with identical same-sex attraction is relatively rare. Certainly not anywhere near 100%. So what causes the inclination to same-sex attraction? If it appears early and involuntarily, right? This is the fact that these people are trying to grapple with. And who, if anyone, is responsible? In determining the answer to the what question, the most widely accepted scientific hypothesis points to random imbalances in maternal hormone levels and identifies their disruptive prenatal effects on fetal development as the likely and major cause. Okay. Then he says, disruptive imbalances in nature. So he's accepting that this is involuntary. He's accepting you are born this way. Disruptive imbalances in nature that thwart encoded processes point to supernatural actors. So here's where he gets to Satan, who, unlike God, do not have the good of persons at heart. In other words, the scientific evidence of how same-sex attraction most likely may be created provides a credible basis for a spiritual explanation that indicts the devil, right? So, you can't say this, right? Because if you say this, you're saying, why does he get fired? They say, oh, they apologize. He made a theological error. No one explains what the theological error is. No one explains what the theological error is. The best thing, you have to infer it. So, here's his retraction apology. Anyone familiar with Catholic history will tell you that the retraction and apology is a favorite form to that. All persons are created in the image and likeness of God. And once again, we have a citation of dignity. So you say that Satan made you this person the way they are. That's somehow an infraction of on this principle. Okay. So that's apparently the principle at stake, and here's the Catholic spokesperson saying the church has not taken a position on nature or nurture. So the church has not posed any theory. Like Herman Cain, they're leaving it open. Maybe they'll come in later when once the evidence is presented. So, you know, so now the problem I have here is they're not answering the question. The guy who loses his job is trying to reconcile the science of inborn homosexuality with the theology. They're saying, no, that answer is not acceptable. But here's the rest of what he said and why this is important. He says, if God causes same-sex attraction and yet commands that it not be satisfied, then this is divine cruelty. Or if God causes same-sex attraction, then it must be the divine will that those with the attraction should act on it. And it is the church that is being cruel in its teaching, or at the very least tragically mistaken about what God wants. Whenever natural causes disturb otherwise typical biological development, leading to the personally unchosen beginnings of same-sex attraction, the ultimate responsibility on a theological level is and should be imputed to the evil one, not God. Applying this aspect of Catholic belief to interpret the scientific data makes more sense because it does not place God in the awkward position of blessing two mutually incompatible realities, sexual difference and same-sex attraction. So the guy is wrestling honestly with this problem. He has been kicked out and the church has not come up with an alternative theory, but he's basically right. He's right that if you're going to accept the science that this is not chosen, that genetics may play a role, hormones can play a role, but that either way, this is not something that one chooses, then you're going to have to reconcile how God could do this. And there's going to be, I think the Catholic Church is going to be fighting with this one for a long time. Okay. Different issue. Drug testing for, how are we doing on time? Okay. Drug testing people who are on welfare. This is an old conservative tradition. Okay, we won't violate your civil liberties, but once you need money, now we hold the strings and now we can sort of do anything we want. But what I want you to notice here is that this is something. Here's how much down at the bottom, $253 a month. That's how much they'd be shelling out in the form of welfare. The drug test. Let's see, did I put the cost of the drug test on here? $40. Okay. The cost is driven down to the point where, gosh, we can drug test these people. And because they're asking for public money, we don't need to worry about the civil liberties part of this. So, you know, we don't have to. We used to be that we would wait until we had a known drug problem. You lost your job. That's an externally verifiable thing, right? You lost your job for drug use, so now we know you're a drug user. We don't have to mess with your body to find out. Or you're convicted of a drug felony. Again, that's an external thing. We know this. But now we don't need to mess with the external stuff. We're going to go right into your body. We're going to make you pee in the cup, and we're going to use the evidence of your body. So this is taking a technology and going inside the body in order to verify what you have, whether you've used the drugs. Okay, you guys all familiar with the shooting of Gabriel Giffords in Tucson? The shooter is declared incompetent to stand trial. So morally we can't punish him because he's not competent, but actually we can drug him. Saying that scientifically he is not capable, he's not competent, does not mean that he's out of the woods. If we can apply some technology to drug you to make you competent, then we do that. And he's actually fighting it. I don't know how this works when you go to court and you say, trust me, I'm competent to ask for you to them not to be allowed to drug me to make me competent to stand trial. But that's where we are with this. Transgender inmates. I was surprised to read this one. This sounds like a Newt Gingrich talking point. It used to be that if you were transgender and you went into prison and you were already receiving, you could have the same standard of care you had before. If you were getting hormones, you could get the hormones. But now you can be diagnosed while you're in prison. You don't have to have the pre-existing diagnosis, and you can receive the hormones. Right, so you have to be diagnosed, but here's why. This is where we get to the Newt Gingrich part. Part of me says, gosh, Newt's right. This is crazy. You go to jail and maybe you couldn't even have afforded the surgery before, but now you're in prison, so we're gonna give you the surgery. Here's what happens sometimes if you don't give the surgery. Okay, for anybody who doesn't believe it's real, the gender identity disorder, when somebody kills themselves or mutilates themselves, okay, that's a pretty good sign that it's real. and that, you know, maybe you should take seriously the disorder and not believe that because it's a mental illness or because it's homosexuality or transsexuality that any of that stuff is not to be taken seriously. Organs. I shouldn't spend too long on organs because these are all about the same thing, which is the buying and selling of organs. And this, a lot of this stuff is in countries. This is Kosovo. I'll show you one from Brazil. Some of these countries, it's illegal, but it doesn't matter because it's life and death. And people will find a way to buy and sell organs. There's an argument, in fact, for legalizing it, for legalizing some financial incentives, financial rewards for donating organs, because if you don't do it, the desperation is so great, you will get a market, okay, whether or not you want one. So here, 80,000, what's that, pounds? Or so, I'm not sure what that comes out to.
Euros,
that's euros, sorry. Yeah, those are... and here, you know, here they've executed prisoners and sold the organs. That's really cheap, right? Hey, they're killing them anyway. You know, let's make some utility. Let's make some good out of the organs, and we'll make a little money on the side. Here's China. China actually has been trying to deal with this problem. Large underground network, profiting from the demand for donor organs. Guy changed his mind. Sorry, you're already in the pipeline. This kid who used his to, you see this, using the money to buy an iPad. So, you know, yeah. What's happened with the market, okay, you know, before there was transplant technology, you couldn't really do this effectively. And now there's also globalization, it's easier to travel, it's easier to transport things. You can bring people from different places, you can sell an organ to somebody, a tourist coming in from another country, from a richer country. What this has done is made parts of your body fungible, okay? Something that you could not sell before, now you can sell. And this affects people. This affects people. If you live in a poor place and you don't have anything, but you've got two kidneys and you only need one, well, now you're thinking, what can I get for this? You know, because you used to be, you would prostitute yourself, right? That was selling your body. But this is literally selling your body, not renting it. Selling part of your body. Right. So what China is doing is trying to they're trying to change their legal system to make it easier to increase the supply of organs, because you can see the supply of organs is not enough, so you can get rid of the market theoretically by making it, basically making the cost zero, right? Which is a sensible libertarian approach, right? If we can make it possible for you to get an organ for nothing, then no one will be able to sell their organs, and that's probably the best way to undercut the market. This is the case from Brazil. It's actually an old case, but it was just the conviction just happened, and you can see how do you facilitate this process. You need somebody on hand, a priest, or in this case, a doctor who functions as a priest, to say, brain dead. And once you're brain dead, that's the authorization, you can take the organs out. And here you can see the peep at the bottom. The people who got the organs didn't know where they came from. And there's a lot of this transplant tourism now. And you can go abroad and you can get a transplant and you got no idea what happened. And if your life is at stake, sometimes you don't want to know. Okay, enough about organs. HPV vaccine, I don't know who followed this. Everybody knows about Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and that whole fight. What's interesting here is that's about HPV vaccine for girls. What the HPV vaccine has messed up all the moral politics, because it's a sexually transmitted disease, which means, for God's sake, we should not vaccinate children for this, you know, without their parents' consent. But this is not for your this is not for gonorrhea. This is for cancer, right? And all of a sudden you have, wait, it's like a floor wax and a dessert topping. It's sexually transmitted, but it's cancer. Well, of course we have to prevent cancer. So a lot of people who are against dealing with sexually transmitted disease in schools and that kind of thing are going to have to rethink this, because it's cancer prevention. Rick Perry did. He did rethink it, if we can call what goes on in Rick Perry's head thinking. But what's here is they're vaccinating the boys. Notice this. Vaccinating boys is cost-effective when vaccination rates in girls are relatively low. What happened here was, as long as the girls were getting, this is like doing the dishes, as long as the girls were getting vaccinated, the boys were safe. We're going to vaccinate half the population. We're going to vaccinate the girls, mostly because the disease burden is higher in girls, but basically, probably it's easier to get the parents to get their girls vaccinated, and generally, women take care of things that men don't take care of. And this starts very early. So trust me, I have a point, girl. So we have, you know, as long as the girls were going to get it, the boys weren't going to have to. But now what's going on is the girls aren't getting it, so now the cost models work better for, well, maybe the boys will have to get it. And so now they're trying to get everybody to get the vaccine. Vegetative patients. I love this one. Okay. They went around This already happened with MRIs. We said these people were vegetative because they were unresponsive, right? They were you do these external tests. You hold up the finger. You do the blinking. You do all these things, and the person does not respond. Oh, and after a certain point of unresponsiveness, you say this person's vegetative. But they did this with fMRI. They could go look at their brain, and they could give them commands, and they can compare this to a normal group of people. What happens in the brain when I tell you to move, wiggle your toe or your finger? And they find that some of these people, this is 3 out of 16, I believe, who some of these people, when you tell them, you know, think about wiggling your finger, they look just like a normal person. They're doing what a normal person would do. So they are able to think, they're just not able to manifest it externally, which is basically changes the definition of vegetative. Because now they are responsive, not with their body, but with their mind. You've changed the barrier between thought and action is what you've done. They're thinking, but the thinking now shows up on a scan, and that becomes an action. That's a behavior you can now measure. So to me, this is totally profound, and what this thing is about is EEG. So they already did this with fMRI, but the EEG is cheap and it's portable. So now you can, something that was theoretical, where you'd have to bring people in and use this expensive thing, and you can take the EEGs around and hook people up and ask them questions. And what you've done is you've created a language. These people can now talk. You can basically create a kind of a Morse code. You know, think about wiggling your toe, think about wiggling your finger, whatever. And now these people will be able to talk to you, right? You'll have a two-way communication, which is, to me, completely amazing. I already said all this stuff. Okay, drones. Do we have enough time to do drones? Do this quickly. Okay, drones. We're using drones everywhere. Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, other countries, Israel's got them. I like this one at the bottom. Pakistan, U.S. assures ally, no boots on the ground. We don't have to put the boots on the ground because they're in the air now. In fact, the boots are on the ground. They're in Nevada, okay? And so we're operating aircraft, killer aircraft, sometimes surveillance aircraft, mostly the unmanned killer aircraft, over these places from far away. What does this do to our notions? This is not a body technology, so I won't spend too long on this stuff, but what does it do to us when we can kill from far away, when it's a little bit like a video game, right? And at first I was totally freaked out by this, but here's the New York Times story on it. So here it is, it's cheap, it's easier, so it's, it makes it easier to wage war, right? But it's safe. That's safe for us, not for them, right? Safe for our people are not at risk. Makes it easier to wage war. That's a little bit scary, right? But it's also more much more precise. And look down at the bottom there. It says there's broad agreement, and this is true, that drones cause far fewer unintended deaths than ground combat conventional airstrikes. And we just had this incident with the fight with the Pakistanis. We killed a couple dozen people. That's what happens when you have to, and part of the reason why that happens in regular warfare is because you're under threat, you're in danger, okay? When you're not in danger, you have the luxury of taking your time. And so I've kind of changed my view about drones. Yeah, it makes it easier to fight the war, yeah, you are safer, but drone strikes are much more accurate because they can watch the house for 2 days. And they can make sure there are no kids in there when they fire it, or they wait until the Al Qaeda guy leaves and gets in the truck, and then they go hit the truck, okay. And when you can choose, you have the ability to be morally selective, and that's a great thing. Child pornography. Here's a guy who gets nailed, gets massive sentence, life without parole for downloading stuff. And what you can see here is no previous criminal record. If he'd actually molested a child, he could have gotten an easier sentence than what he got for the child porn, but it piles up because there's so much of it. And what they point out in here, acquiring child pornography requires, the theory was that it requires a lot of time and effort, but that is no longer true. With the internet, now you can download, get all this porn. So with the click of a button, this guy says it was an accident, I don't really believe that, but the point is it doesn't take much of a threshold to download a bunch of child porn. And that's changed what we can assume about someone's predisposition to actually behaving. And what does it mean, you know, the whole nature of child pornography is very cool. Child pornography that's totally animated, you know, where there's no... So now you have this kind of sickness and you're afraid that these people will go out and do something, but they haven't actually touched anybody. And in fact, sometimes they haven't even looked at anything that's a real child. Okay, there no children were harmed in the making of this, you know, animated whatever it is. It's disgusting, but, you know, how should we punish it? Similar, text message bullying. What the hell is text message bullying? When I was a kid, bullying meant somebody punched you. You know, so you have the exceptions. The kids are being harassed by texting, rude or mean comments, being picked on, bullied by a text. To me, it's not even that someone's not even talking to your face, but you can see that the technology is taking something that used to be. And I think someone, I don't have the quote in here, a guy who really knows about this says, you know, this is a lot better than the way it used to be. I mean, and he's sort of right. GPS, okay, we track cars. The cops can track cars with GPS. But and they did here. They did it without a warrant, and this is being contested in the Supreme Court. But the argument of the U.S. Solicitor General in this case is you can track people as long as they're in public. Okay, privacy means we can't go into your house, but we can go onto your body. We can go onto your body. We can attach it to your clothing because you're in public. So the privacy pertains to the location, but not to how close this is to you physically. What do we think about that? And this is, you know, I'm going to skip this one. This, I think, is one of the last ones. This is about dating and whether the ability to find. You guys know about Grindr? Who knows about Grindr? Okay, so Grindr is like largely, you know, that's sort of the place for guys to meet other guys. And because it's guys, I'm sorry, I'm revealing too much sexism here, but, you know, there's a lot of sex, okay? And it's like you're shown, you can see a profile, you don't find out that much about the person, but what you find out is how close they are. Are they near you? What do they look like? Well, if you have that kind of information, that's how you're going to be choosing. And here, what they're talking about is, how do we design this technology, and how does that change the way that we relate to each other and who we look for? So we have these mating, she says, the having this app allows you to skip these mating rituals, which some people say it would be good to have mating rituals. In online dating, it takes a long time, but now you have to get to know the person. There's all this ice to break. Here, there's no ice to break. You can communicate very easily without looking face to face. You can move really quickly with this app instead of like finding someone who's far away and then you say, should we meet? I wonder, should we meet? You know, or what's it going to be like? Here, the person's right around the corner, and so you get much more quickly to the actual meeting. And I don't know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that going to make people choose on physical features? But down here it says, so Grindr has only the user's picture and location, but you can basically, with the technology, you can design the software any way you want to include any kind of criteria. Population control, blah, 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 skip that one. Okay. Mostly what I'd like to do is just stop here and throw it open, and any topic you guys want to ask about or talk about, let's hear what you have to say.
Thank you. So I'm sure there are many questions. I'm saying that looking at my students. But I'm going to open it up. What's it been like for a journalist, particularly you kind of work at the intersection of politics and science? What are the difficulties you have in interesting people in these issues, or don't you? And how have you seen the political trade winds change in the 10 years or so that you've been on this beat?
There's the political question, and there's the interest level. The interest question is a big problem. This is, I was covering politics, and I was watching this stuff out of the corner of my eye, and I said, this is way more important. This is way more interesting. This is real change. This is going to be. I told Jonathan, 100 years from now, this was the story. I mean, September 11th happened. You know, all the stuff happened, but these changes, just completely, they're gradual. They will radically transform society. I found it very difficult to get people interested in them because they're incremental. It's hard. It's like people are interested, and I've thought about this. I've had a lot of trouble getting traffic. In fact, I had my mandate to do this yanked away from me. So I used to be able to spend all my time on this, and now I have to spend a lot of time covering politics, which is interesting when half your candidates are committing adultery. But but still, it's not deeply meaningful except to the people who are involved in the the mandate got because I'm not getting enough traffic for it. And the traffic is, if I write about Herman Cain's adultery, I get plenty of traffic. I write about this stuff, not getting enough traffic. And I've thought a lot about it. I think a lot of the big problem is narrative. I think we're narrative creatures. We need stories, we need characters. And it can't be the scientists themselves. It's just too slow, the whole process is too slow. And people need to see how this relates to them. So my original concept for how to do this, I think I need to find a way to go back to that. I need to be farther away from the science and more squarely on the cultural stuff. Bringing the science into it tangentially, but I've tried. The science is happening constantly. You guys who follow, you know, anybody here who follows scientific, if you go to the Reuters Health and Science wires, this stuff is just churning out. You go to Eureka Alert, I mean, it's like drinking from a fire hose. But the problem is relating it to people. And people, they just will not care unless it gets onto something. They love hot button issues. They love right and wrong. But you try to explain something like, the artificial kidney. They can take this tissue and they can put it in a canister, and it's going to be like interchangeable parts. They're going to be able to plug it in. They're going to make it easier to transplant. And I'm just not getting a response. You know, the numbers are not adding up. So that's a problem. The political study, but you also asked about the politics. And I can't figure out the politics. Part of the problem with figuring out the politics is because the politics rarely intersects with it self-consciously. I don't see much. What I see is political changes in bioethics. So what I see is, you know, people think in the Supreme Court, you have a court that's, seven justices vote for Roe v. Wade. And then a bunch of Republican presidents get in and change all these justices, and the numbers start shifting. It takes like 20, 30 years, and they're almost going to overturn Roe v. Wade, and they get there, and then they oh my God, one of our guys voted the other way, and then Obama comes in. It's glacial. It's totally glacial. And the Supreme Court also will go back and look at, you know, they have precedent. They have to at least rationalize what they want to do. Is in line with precedent. Bioethics is just like, there's a Clinton bioethics commission, right? And then in comes the Bush administration. And this goes, we just move this to another website. It becomes a private thing. And it's like, it never happened. And in comes the Bush Bioethics Council. And I like the Bush Bioethics Council because they were interested in all these sort of, you know, far-right issues that some of, you know, they were criticized for that. And they also shortened the name of it, God bless them, President's Council on Bioethics. They made it as short as possible. That was beautiful. They had a bunch of conservatives, and then they had some moderates and a couple of liberals. They were fine. And then in comes the Obama administration, and the Bush Council disappears, and nobody cares about it. It's not only that what they said doesn't matter anymore, it's that what they asked about doesn't matter. All the questions are different. So when the Obama people come in, so the Bush people were all about the far-out future. Oh, this wild technology and what's going to happen. And even though it was like none of it was exactly happening, that's not entirely true, but a lot of the embryo stuff was pretty far-fetched. Certainly the beyond therapy stuff was futuristic. And so in comes the Obama Council, and I'm watching the Obama Council, and the Obama Council seems to be about the past. We're going to talk about the future. We're going to talk about the past. And there's going to be all this, all the liberal stuff, right? Human subjects, you know, consent, fairness. Distribution of resource. To me these are more boring questions. They're practical, but they're anyway. The thing is, if Romney comes in, which is kind of what I'm expecting to happen, he's going to bring back some. He's going to have his own council. It'll be just like the Bush people. Maybe they'll even try to bring back their own questions and maybe we'll end up with this alternating thing. But I don't even know. Did the Obama people resurrect the NBAC? Or is it just a completely different? Do they treat it with the same disregard as they treat the Bush stuff?
Well, I'm not at liberty to say. There's a report in draft may end up citing NBAC on something.
But it would be great if there were. It would be great if bioethics were somehow. I mean, bioethics needs to figure out what it is exactly, but. Maybe it would be better to institutionalize it in some way so that the work of 4 years or 8 years isn't just completely swept away as meaningless somehow. I guess I would like for there to be a conversation, okay, where you at least have to, the way the Supreme Court, even if it's nine completely different justices from 30 years ago, they still have to talk to those justices. They have to read what they wrote and somehow reconcile why, you know, it's compatible. And I would love for there to be a little more interaction.
But why are you focusing on president's councils? I mean, you're assuming that's somehow central, and you're upset because it's incoherent. But why are you assuming it's central? Nobody else does.
What do you think is central?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say that there's an ongoing discussion among academics that doesn't have a particular website, but that hopefully, you know, a certain amount of the gold rises to the top and at least has to be taken account of.
Mm-hmm. So that's great. That's great. I don't know. You could probably tell me more about the politics of that than I could tell you. Feel free.
No, I mean, I don't know that I want to talk about the politics of it, but I'm just saying the notion that you get good bioethics by having a president appoint somebody strikes me as odd. I mean, and do most people ever thought that that was the way to go? I don't think so.
Well, they're smart people on all these commissions. Yeah. They're smart people. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't? I mean, we get dumb people all the time. We get dumb people on the Supreme Court. We get dumb people in the White House. And I mean, wouldn't you like the institutions to be designed so that, you know, even people who are not particularly helpful, you know, can be made to be more helpful?
Look, I'm a fan of Amy Guthrie, but I'd rather she just wrote a book that we could read than have somebody else tell her, to some extent, how to spend her time.
Yeah. Well, there's an argument for that.
I think Dr. Musling, he's proposing a new model for this ballet concert. Like he said, why don't we do with the concert like we do with the Supreme Court? Let these people that are going to be permanent, and it's going to be a continuation.
Mm-hmm.
He has three different proposals
to
do that.
And that would have its own problems.
Well, it's, of course, look at the Supreme Court. But anyway, there are some people thinking about it. How
right. I'm trying to imagine the confirmation hearing.
Yeah, I mean,
for the Supreme Court, the candidate can always say, "I'm not allowed. I can't talk about that. You know, I'm not going to, you know, get into the future hypotheticals and future." I mean, I don't know what the bioethics nominee would say.
I don't know. This
you can't say it's too far in the future because it's all in the future. Come on.
Come on, guys.
Topics, questions, something you're interested in something that wasn't covered.
When I first read that story about personhood in Mississippi, the first thing I thought of was, who's going to pay for all those persons? You know, you have your, you know, the social welfare, the insurance companies. And to me, sometimes I think economics rules the day more than sometimes ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And I read an article one time where insurance companies were being pushed by the Christian right not to pay for birth control. When they realized the cost to them of unplanned pregnancies, they said, no way. So, I mean, I think there's a consideration of economics that we don't even talk about that's a big part of that.
Right, and there's a backlash to it because this is one of the arguments against Planned Parenthood for a long time has been that these, the argument population control, birth control, sort of like you get into the eugenics and undesirables and all that stuff, but there's a lot of sort of economic rationale. People shouldn't be having kids who can't afford to raise them. Right? They're going to end up on the public tab. And now, you know, with the economy being the way it is, there's even a stronger argument for that. But there's a backlash against that from the totally values-driven people who are like, babies, 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 you know, and, you know, this is, if you start thinking this way, you know, they just want, and this is very popular in Atlanta. There were these billboards that were put up in the black community sort of trying to sort of, and it's a wedge issue. Sort of like they're Planned Parenthood's out to do genocide, right? Why? Because they have to look where the clinics are. They're, you know, in our, and so there's an overlap of race, of economics, and then there's this sort of backlash of you're trying to kill us to save money or because, you know, we think we're less capable of taking care of our kids or whatnot. Yeah. But there certainly is there's an argument for, you know, prevention. That sort of, you know, that's not, I don't know. I have problems with abortion personally, but I just can't get wrap my head around the baby people. Like the notion that you're supposed to push this process forward. Like instead of abortion, we want a baby. No, it's an unwanted pregnancy. It's in bad circumstances. You wanted to have prevented this pregnancy in the first place. You want to do everything possible to prevent the conception and then the growth and then you don't want it to get to 20 weeks, right? But this notion that we should be trying to adoption, you know, more. This is just not. It's crazy. And society's never been able to support all these kids who would naturally be born if we didn't practice, you know, birth control.
But that would make reproductive freedom more egalitarian, like the argument against eugenics. Like Planned Parenthood clinics in the poor neighborhoods makes reproductive freedom much more equal. Because why shouldn't poor people be able to, you know...
Yeah, but if you have a conspiratorial view of Planned Parenthood, that it's about killing babies, then...
People can have conspiratorial views of everything.
Right.
Exacerbated by the chapter in Freakonomics.
Yeah.
Associated the drop in the crime rate in the last 30 years for access to abortion services.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And there's a lot of that's a whole other area where things that can be true at a macro level, when you bring them down to the micro level, people's feelings totally change. And that's just it's true of utility in general. Utility is much more easy to make moral judgments based on utility at a macro level. And in fact, you could probably say that's natural. That, like, you know, we have these different ways of thinking. You could think about virtue, you could think about deontology, you could think about utility, and that maybe the bigger you get, the more you should think about utility. And that there's some kind of larger moral, you know, theory about moral theories. That might make sense. But when you bring it down to the small level and talk about aborting this fetus because we can't afford, you know, that people get very uncomfortable with that.
It seems like science advances and we react to it politically, legally, and you have tons of examples of that happening. If you look as a journalist out into your environment, who do you see that's trying to change that reactivity dynamic and look to shape things a little bit more proactively in partnership with science? Where do you see anybody trying to do that, or are we always just going to react to science?
I think bioethicists talk about this all the time, trying to get more involved, trying to get, you know, you want to be in conversation with or networked or part of a research institution, somebody who's doing this stuff, so that basically the people who don't think about ethics for a profession are not just sort of going in doing everything before they've thought about it, right? You want to have some reflection that's built into the process. And I'm sympathetic to that because basically the science is totally running away from, the ethics is very slow, and the science is totally running away from it. And that's, I think that's only getting, it's like the universe expanding. I think that problem's only getting worse. But on the other hand, as I hear your question, I'm sort of torn the other way because we're so bad at anticipating things. We're bad at anticipating what's going to happen, what we should be, we worry about the wrong things, and then we're at what's going to be good or bad. There's, in bioethics, and on the, I've seen this principle tossed around in the Obama Commission and other contexts about prudent vigilance, I think was the term that the Obama Council used in talking about synthetic biology. And the idea is, there's, you know, you guys, who knows precautionary principle? Everybody? Who knows who's heard prudent vigilance? It may be a new name for something that you guys have heard under a different rubric. But so precautionary principle is, if in doubt, don't. You know, we don't do anything until the presumption is against acting. And the prudent vigilance principle, and Jonathan can tell me more about this. I read it in the council's report, and I really liked it. And I think Alan Buchanan presented this argument. But the idea was, start doing it. Be careful. You know. Pause before going in, okay? Think about it. If it's not prohibitive, start doing it. Do the stuff you're sure about. And watch what happens. See what happens. We'll start doing stuff with embryos. We'll see what the technology produces. We'll see it may turn out that we can induce pluripotent cells in some way without destroying embryos, or, you know, it may turn out that doesn't work the way we thought it did. But you as you move along, you reflect on what's happening, and maybe you change the attitude you went in with. And you wouldn't have known that until you went in and started doing it, okay? So you're learning from I like this prudent vigilance idea. I like it because, the model for life should be intercourse, not masturbation. So you want to be interacting with something that isn't you, okay? And that's how you're going to learn and grow. Okay, I'm sorry. No offense to masturbation, but really, you learn. So here we're talking about intercourse between your values that you're going in with, and your assumptions about what's right or wrong, and the facts of what you're going to either learn or create. Okay, so you're having. The sooner you can start that dialectic, the better, right? That's what gets you the reflection. A bunch of people in Mississippi walking around with signs, personhood, 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 and we're not gonna, you know, that's that they're not learning. Maybe we'll end up there. Maybe we'll end up that they're right about that. I mean, actually, think in the long run, there's pro-lifers are right about a lot of stuff about acknowledging life before birth, but you want to let in vitro fertilization, let the technology develop. Maybe it turns out that we can transfer fewer embryos to the womb. that's what's happening, right? We're finding out that by doing the technology, we don't have to freeze or flush, or we don't have to, not freeze or flush, we don't have to, we're not going to end up with so many reductions, right? And that's a great thing, and that's something we learn by doing.
So that's the standard public policy process that you just described, advocated by people like John Dewey. I mean, that is supposed to be what... The problem is, the response, and I want to hear your response to this, is that people say, well, the problem is, the devil is in what you decide to measure as relevant to the outcomes you're talking about. So, I'm a cultural conservative. Yeah, good thing about IVF, we don't have to destroy as many embryos and freeze them forever.
Yeah.
Bad thing, we're undermining male-female relationships and courtship, and we see what this leads to. So, how do you measure the latter? That's the real danger of all these new reproductive technologies. We can measure how many embryos we create and don't implant or do, but how do you measure the implications, the larger social implications of messing around with how we make people?
Right, but is that a question that they would have formulated earlier, or did we get to that formulation of that question by going through this, going into the science?
Well, Leon Cash was opposed to IVF at the beginning. Mm-hmm. He says he's changed his view,
There's nothing like personal experience. So I mentioned to you that the guy who ran the campaign has two IVF kids, and that I have two little nieces they're not little anymore, and they're IVF kids. You can't have an IVF kid in your family and mouth this stuff about, it changes you. It's just like having somebody in your family who you know is gay, or somebody who's, and if you look at, I showed you the stats on that the thing about homosexuality and whether it's innate. Massive, massive changes in public opinion about homosexuality everybody, this from talking to people, but if you look at polling data over the last 40 years, it's just it's gone. This thing, the taboo is sort of there, but something that existed for forever and ever has just been mowed down. It has been mowed down by two things. One is people coming out. Just note, if you look at the cross-tabulations on these polls, what drives people to accept homosexuality? Number one, do I know somebody who's openly gay? Do I know I know somebody who's gay? Right. And number two, do I think it's a choice? And those, what science is totally undermining that. I totally ran away from your original question. You were talking about public policy. Oh, measuring. But what we measure, isn't that part of the same process? We start out measuring something, and then you learn, shit, this other thing's happening. That's what we should be measuring this too. And so in the middle of, and this happens in studies all the time, right? We're sort of you're using the drug for this, and then there's some side effect you weren't thinking about, or there's some benefit you weren't thinking. Viagra, What was Viagra originally? I can't remember. It was for circulation or something? Yeah, it's you find out, it has this side effect, and now we're gonna design a whole new study to measure this other thing. So, all right.
Do you think bioethics in a certain way is too powerful, has too much voice? It's not, you're sitting in one of the little cathedrals of bioethics, but they're not big numbers, they're not huge numbers of bioethicists. If you divided them up, in their politics and all that, you're probably counting 48 over there and 111 over here and that kind of thing, not counting students, but hired professional full-time ones. Why do we actually worry about their musing so much? Or to put it another way, somebody once said to me, why should I listen to you? And I actually couldn't come up with any answer. Just a view, I don't know.
Art, where do bioethics have, where do they have power?
People say in the culture, culture wars, they go nuts over what, sort of frothing in the mouth, you're going to defend this, it's just chat about science and technology and medicine. I don't know. Wouldn't whip myself into that much of a frenzy over it. But it seems to get pretty heated sometimes. Let's put it that way.
Controversy about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see bioethics as having power at all. In fact, I'm just like, to, the more I've learned about this stuff.
Change it to attention or something. I don't mean power like driving policy, but, commanding cocktail party chat,
right,
that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's become, I'm guilty of this. I changed the title. I made the thing, the title of this was about culture wars. I know that people love culture wars. So And you know, bioethics has gained sort of attention for good or ill as it's gotten, as it's messed with the culture wars. But there's, I think there's a deep insecurity, and I'm going beyond what I know to what I said, stuff that a lot of people on the right are very, very anxious about, well, they're anxious about science, the process of science and technology sort of overrunning old-fashioned values. And sometimes they see bioethicists of the left as sort of, you know, enablers of that. You're the priests who come with this religion of secularism, tell us nothing matters. But the people, when I hear the word bioethics, it's always on the right. I mean, I'm constantly, and there's this, bioethics has become, for like the right-wing blogs, the cultural conservatives, it's become a way of dressing up their values as science. So they, you know, everything is, in ethics, there's like, ethics makes it sound like orderly thought, right? And bio gives it this sort of scientific tinge. And so it makes them feel like they're speaking a common language, and that they'll have some, they'll be able to persuade the public somehow if they call it bioethics instead of religion, right? So religion is gone, bioethics is, people don't believe in God anymore, but they do believe in science, so we'll take the same values we had, and instead of attaching it to God, we'll attach it to science, no matter how tenuous the connection, and that will give it some authority. So they have their own counter bioethics. I'm not at all answering your question, I think, but.
Well, you are. I think some of it is, in the cultural conversation, you can't talk religion in public for long. Yeah. I mean, if Mitt Romney does it, he won't be president. He's mumbling about Mormonism or something. So the best we've got is some secularized, deracinated ethical chat that bioethics has constructed, and that seems to me where you have to go. That would be that's my read on why it has cultural prominence. I didn't mean to say power, but sort of, attention, command.
Yeah.
People watching, because it's how we talk to one another about even issues around cloning. I always thought, well, that's about what personhood is. We get into this brain death stuff. It's sort of like, well, when you're alive, when you're dead. But who's going to talk about that? If you can't do it under religious frameworks, then what do you got?
Right.
You got nothing.
Right.
People do want to talk about it.
Yeah. And it is great, even if it's fake, it's great. I mean, in the sense that the fake, being fake is the beginning of being real. You know, you tell the kid, look, act like you care. You know, go kiss grandma or whatever it is. Like, and there's, I mean, I think there's science that basically shows that behaving in certain ways will gradually make you more like that. Not always, but you know, so if you start with you say, all right, we want to. If conservatives start with the view, and I don't mean to insult conservatives in the room, I have some conservative sympathies myself, but if you start from the view that, look, we have these values, and people no longer believe in God like we do, so we need to find a way to talk to them, and you say, you know, we're going to talk about this in terms of science. It's actually, the process itself is not deception. The process is talking yourself into this, right? So you actually believe that it is grounded in science. Science says, this is a person, see? And they want to draw all sorts of moral conclusions from you know, the genetics of this. So they start by thinking of this as a persuasive tool. They talk themselves into it. And then, you know, it becomes a way of having a conversation. If you have a bioethics council, I mean, the Bush Bioethics Council, you had, you know, Christians and, you know, secular people, and they had to have a conversation, and so you can have the conversation. You can't have the conversation if it's all about scripture, right? You got Jews, you got other things. So, but you can have the conversation if you're sort of making reference to science and scientific authority. And one of the main reasons why I love science and why I, you know, refuse to give it up no matter what my editors want me to do is, in science, science resists you. I was talking earlier about intercourse. Science says no. Science says, you know, you can't spin your way out of this. This is not going to work. You know, you drop the ball, it will fall down. I don't care how many times you say it's going up. Do it again, it will fall down. And there's something powerful about that resistance, and it can ground people, and it can make it possible to have, you know, that is a real objective term of reference. And I think that over time that has an effect on people, so that when the science doesn't produce their religious conclusion, some of them will say, okay, and they'll relax and come along.
Let's get a couple of more student questions. Yeah. So
whoever wants to go first.
I'm really interested in the your little slide, your article about persistent vegetative state, and you mentioned maybe there was some sort of potential for communicating.
Is
that anywhere close to actually being done, like developing a means of communication with these persistent vegetative state patients? And if so, is there a drive to change policy or definitions of neurological injury in mm-hmm. response?
And next year at Wimbledon, there'll be a PBS contender. They'll be thinking about
tennis.
It just seems like your idea about prudent vigilance would have a lot to say about a case like that, where if we can establish this rapport, it turns out that maybe a lot of the people we've been treating as next to dead may have had much more sentience and awareness
right.
of what was going on.
Yeah. And I don't want to exaggerate it, like the Terry Schiavo case.
Sure, exactly.
General agreement, she was liquefied, and that was not gonna happen in that case.
Yeah.
So we don't know. You have to go around and do that. But I don't know exactly where they are with this. Just going to EEG was a big step, because they have to get a technology that's portable that you can go around with and that's practical. I mean, you can already, someone who is not vegetative, there are people who can, if you can only move a finger or something, you can communicate with your finger, you can blink, okay? I could blink once for, this, yes, for no, two for no.
Sure.
So this is just taking that concept and taking it inside the mind, and I don't know where they are in terms of, but now that they have a technology, so you can, the process is we can make it technologically possible and bring the cost down, and now we can talk about policy in a more effective way.
Do you see that, just to get the politics in, do you see that as the next wedge argument? Are there advocacy groups, do you think, looking for a case?
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen them pushing this. And I think, I mean, the big political picture is that these issues are just not going to be central for a while. They're not going to be central because of the economy. Art was talking about bioethics being a hot issue. I remember, what was the first big, George W. Bush gives that speech. No one remembers it now, August of 2001. The first, major speech about bioethics by a president, and that's completely erased by September 11th. So what happens is foreign policy, military stuff, security comes in, and there's only so much room on the nation's plate for people to think about stuff. So that wiped the cultural stuff and the ethics off the map. And now we have the economy, and just you're not going to get people to focus on it. So if you're on the right, the people who might raise that when the economy's better. I mean, think of when was abortion at its hottest? During the Clinton years, the economy was going gangbusters, no wars. What's there to argue about? Let's fight about culture. But it's a luxury that we don't indulge in when the economy is like it is now.
We have time for two more.
Okay. I think this guy waited for the last.
You mentioned before about the kidney transplants going on,
yep.
and I like that you brought in the word fungibility. I'm doing my final paper on how transplant and all that interchangeability of parts affects the way people think about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of alluded that you think it does affect the way people think about themselves, so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how or what evidence you've seen or any of that in some of the work you've done.
I haven't looked at the organ sales stuff for a while. You certainly see people. I've definitely seen articles about people going online. So with internet access, you can find out quick. You can find out that there are people who are paying who are paying and how much they might pay for an organ. This is the kind of information. It's not things that aren't easy to go around and talk about. So. I mean, not face to face. So, it's been. I'm not sure if I can really answer your question. The ability of people to travel has changed. The ability to find out how much money someone will pay you for something, even somebody far away, has changed. In terms of how people think about, so it isn't so much how they think about themselves. It's just these things gradually get into your consciousness.
It's increasingly an option, so it's just something people are willing to consider.
Yeah, it's something that wasn't even on your radar before. And if you're desperately poor, I think it is like think about things that before you could sell an organ, before organs are transplantable. What do people you'd prostitute yourself, or you would you're desperately looking for something that somebody wants from you that you can sell, and so this becomes it. Yeah.
You mentioned how science moves a lot faster than ethics, and I was wondering if you have thought of some ways in which we we could speed up the development of the ethics. Things like maybe, you know, having bioethic commissions at the FDA in order to develop upcoming scientific developments or...
I haven't thought enough about this question, and my reaction on listening to you as I'm just, it's too, anything, almost anything institutional will be too slow. What you actually need to do is get the bioethics into the brain of the people who are doing the work. And it doesn't have to be any, it just basic concepts. So you want to make sure that the scientists themselves know enough to have a conversation or to call somebody up or ask about, you know, I don't know if you're going to be able to. I mean, I don't know.
What conversation do you want them to have? What do you want the scientists to converse about?
I don't have a good answer to this. In general, I try to avoid the worst. The best is, you know, we can worry about the best. As people who think they know the best scare me, because half the time, you know, we end up with Chairman Mao or something like that. So I just want to avoid the worst. And the worst to me is when I see some scientist, you know, interviewed who has clearly not thought at all, not even aware that there is any, you know, ethical question at stake in what he or she is doing. And that happens a lot, because the field draws people who are interested in how things work. It draws, you know, and you might be a really thoughtful scientist about other things, but you're generally interested in the science. And I constantly see and hear these comments from people who just haven't thought at all. And I guess I would like, you know, just to get make sure that they're having conversations.
I want them to do science. I think we need to think as a society what things we can put up with, what things we can't. But I want my scientists doing science. Uh-huh. I want my surgeon doing my surgery. I don't want to bifurcate everybody. I think they need to do what they do.
Well, is it bifurcation or is it integration?
Okay, fair. But I don't want them really. I really want the majority of their energy going into science.
Uh-huh.
I would prefer that.
I think you could get, I mean, you know, on a percentage basis, I'd be happy to give you, you know, 99.5% science. Yeah. I want the person to be aware of, to know enough to think, get yourself something going on here that I need to either think about or talk to somebody about. Because I think any, you know, you can have a review board, but I just think it's too slow. If it's not happening, if you say, we have this review board, this is not going to happen in our institution, somebody's doing it in Singapore, somebody's doing it somewhere else, it's a private, you know, a company's doing it, or you need to diffuse this.
Research ethics were developed, right? And now they know what they have to be.
Yeah.
So you actually will see some discussion about this very problem, I think, in the next President's Commission report, which will be due out in a couple of weeks. And you will see some discussion about integrating ethics into the thoughts of the way scientists are trained in their culture. Just to note that we do have 5% of the National Human Genome Research Institute budget is devoted to bioethics. There's a debate about whether that's been a good investment or not. So that's a model that people are arguing about. And of course, the whole field of human research ethics came out of a period which people thought that the virtue of the scientist was sufficient. But that hasn't always been the case. So these are not, just to point out as a historian, these are not new conversations.
But yeah.
We very much appreciate the perspective of the journalist and the ethical journalist. Who's willing to share with us perspectives we don't usually get in an academic center. So thank you very much. And those of you who signed up for dinner, please stick around.